The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov, with all the talk about the war yesterday, we didn't have much time to talk about Tisha B'Av. But one of the interesting things for me, of course, Tisha B'Av, the actual ninth day of Av fell on Shabbat, not on Sunday, even though the fast was marked on Sunday, because in the case of Tisha B'Av, Shabbat trumps Tisha B'Av, and therefore the fast day was moved to Sunday. And it was interesting that in spite of the fact that the operation Breaking Dawn was going on in the background, and obviously there were discussions about the possibility of missiles being fired towards Jerusalem, and in fact, during the course of Sunday morning at one point, there were a number of missiles fired in the direction of Jerusalem. But it was interesting that the Temple Mount wasn't really the flashpoint that we thought it could be and it might be under the circumstances. And there are reports that suggest that up to 2,000 Jewish visitors were managed to make their way to the Temple Mount on Tisha B'Av. And some of the reports suggest that that is the most number of Jewish visitors to the Temple Mount since the days of the Second Temple.
Wow, wow.
So that was quite an astonishing statistic that I read somewhere. I don't know how true it is, and I would like to tell people that I'm simply quoting others where I've read this. So I haven't managed to fact check or verify this particular piece of information, but it was just fascinating that it was even mentioned as a thing.
Very, very interesting that. Wow. It's worth looking into to see if that is factually correct. A number of people are reported to have been injured in a clash between the IDF, their troops, and Palestinians in the area of Nablus this morning. What's happening here?
Yeah, so this is a breaking story. A firefight broke out between IDF troops and Palestinians in the Nablus area, also known as Shechem. Nablus and Shechem, they're the same place. We understand from the reports that the IDF entered Nablus in order to arrest the head of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade by the name of Ibrahim Nabulsi. Apparently, he was hiding out in an apartment in Shechem. He's a person that has managed to escape IDF arrest on a number of previous occasions. And the reports that we've seen coming out of Shechem this morning say that a firefight broke out, that quite a number of people on the Palestinian side have been injured, one or two of them even potentially quite seriously injured, as IDF troops have been forced to defend themselves, coming under gunfire as they were trying to enter this apartment. There are reports that suggest that even 11 people might have been injured, not clear exactly what their situation is, but from what I've gathered, Nabulsi was there and that he probably has been arrested. No particular confirmation yet that he has been taken into custody. But this is an interesting development following Operation Breaking Dawn, because we all recall that it was the arrest in that particular area of Bassam al-Saadi, who was a commander, is a commander of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. He was arrested in the Jenin area in the middle of last week, and that's really what then propelled us into the weekend Operation Breaking Dawn. Now the focus is on the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, who are very, very closely associated with Fatah. Fatah, of course, being Mahmoud Abbas's party, Fatah very much associated with the Palestinian Authority. So this is a completely different focus now. This is focusing more on the Judea and Samaria area rather than what might be going on in Gaza. So it's going to be interesting to see how this one develops, particularly in view of the fact that so many people have been injured this morning. And the reports have said that no IDF troops have been injured in these particular clashes. But of course, this is still a developing story.
Mm. And certainly we'll keep an eye on this one. Further information emerging about Operation Breaking Dawn, particularly some statistics about the conflict. What's been made public?
So first of all, it was just interesting to see how the ceasefire went into effect at 11:30 p.m. on Sunday night. There were a few last missiles that were fired soon after the ceasefire went into effect that came from the Gaza side, but that really didn't affect the ceasefire in any substantial way. And by 9 o'clock yesterday morning, the Gaza border crossing was open. It was completely open. The residents were released from their homes in the Gaza envelope area. Roads were open. The train service was returned all yesterday morning. And the Gaza border crossing went open to allow the inflow, particularly of fuel for the Gaza power plant, which had run out of fuel during the weekend operation, and to allow so-called humanitarian aid, which was really in the form of vegetables and fresh fruit and food that was going into Gaza. So it was just as dramatically as things escalated and things went into a full mode of almost a war situation, so it de-escalated quite, almost as quickly. The ceasefire went into existence, and by within less than 12 hours after the ceasefire coming into existence, there was almost a normal flow of activity along the Gaza border yesterday. There was one little snippet, one little issue that came up, which was the issue of the release of al-Saadi, who had been arrested last week, and we were told by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad side that that was one of the conditions of the ceasefire, that Egypt would make sure that Israel released al-Saadi. That was apparently from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad side, one of their conditions. The Israeli side denied that they've agreed to release al-Saadi. The Egyptians are, of course, are in the middle of all of this. It seems as if the Palestinian Islamic Jihad side did get the Egyptians to say that they would work towards his release. But as far as we work out, the Israelis did not agree to that as part of the ceasefire provisions. So it's one of those things that I think was left with the middleman rather than with anybody else in terms of an agreement. And there were threats yesterday that Palestinian Islamic Jihad would renew the conflict if that particular clause wasn't adhered to. So far, things have been pretty quiet. Israel continues to insist upon the fact that there was no agreement to release him. We will see how that one works out over the coming days and weeks. But just in terms of the Operation Breaking Dawn, this was a 66-hour operation. So as I said yesterday, if the six-day war went down as legendary in terms of what it was achieved in a very, very short period of time, surely this operation, maybe not in the same, maybe not quite as legendary, not in the same status, because, of course, during the Six-Day War, there was that matter of reunifying Jerusalem, which will always go down in legend. This one, not quite so much, but certainly a massive amount achieved in a short 66-hour operation. Apparently, the IDF struck 170 targets. They killed quite a number of high-ranking Islamic Jihad operatives. They destroyed much of the terrorist organization's military capabilities, their terrorist attack tunnels, their weapon storage facilities, their rocket launch sites. There was a lot of activity, a lot of intense activity that the IDF was responsible for, and they really had their targets very much ready to go. It was quite noticeable how quickly they went into action and how the targets were destroyed one after the other, both in terms of the assassinations of the key individuals and in terms of the physical targets that the IDF went after. In terms of the number of people who were killed, well, let's start with the number of rockets that were fired. 1,100 rockets were fired during 66 hours of operation. Apparently, out of those 1,100 rockets, something like 200 of them didn't actually cross the Gaza border. 200 of those rockets, almost 20% of the rockets fired, actually landed within Gaza in some way, shape, or form. And of those rockets that actually did cross the border, something like 380 of them were intercepted by the Iron Dome anti-missile system, which means that the remaining rockets, approximately 600 or so, landed either in the sea or in open spaces. There were a few out of the rockets that also have been intercepted that were not intercepted by Iron Dome for one reason or another. The success rate that Iron Dome is boasting during Operation Breaking Dawn is 95% success rate, which is an amazing success rate for a system like Iron Dome. But unfortunately, of course, the 5% that slipped through are quite damaging potentially, and they did cause damage to property, and of course there were some injuries. Now, in terms of the number of casualties, a total number of 35 people are reported to have been killed during the operation on the Palestinian side, of whom, interestingly, 26 are considered to have been innocent bystanders. So that means that there were 9 people who were the senior commanders, operatives that the Israelis went after, who were killed in the operation. 26 innocent bystanders. Of the 26 innocent bystanders, 15 of them were actually killed by Palestinian Islamic Jihad rockets rather than by being what they might like to call collateral damage from the Israeli firing. So there were civilians who were killed by Israeli airstrikes, 11 according to the statistics that I've read. And 15 people killed by Islamic Jihad. So it all goes to show that in terms of the innocent civilians, Islamic Jihad killed more of their own people than the Israelis did by the rocket strikes, which is also an interesting statistic. There was a call made by Prime Minister Yair Lapid to Egyptian President al-Sisi to thank him for the work that they did to intermediate to mediate the ceasefire. They, of course, are always the middle people, and they managed to bring that ceasefire into existence quite quickly. So that's really how we see Operation Breaking Dawn in the with the benefit of one day of hindsight, looking back on what happened, just, you know, in terms of what we know right now.
Yeah, it's certainly, and we're seeing a tremendous amount of support of this from the United States, which I think has been very, very important and comforting in many ways. South Africa, as we've spoken about, I haven't spoken about it to you, but South Africa, not exactly being supportive of Israel, and of course, just making things up as they go along.
I think that with the operation being as short as it was, it didn't really allow the international community to come out with any concerted response in one direction or the other. And I think that that's one of the interesting things about managing to do things just very quickly, going in and out. You haven't really given enough time for the world to come to a view, to express condemnation or support or wherever it's going to be. There were certainly words of support from the United States. Also, some concern about civilian casualties. So they felt the need to try somehow to balance up and the support that they were giving to Israel. No surprise that the Russians came out condemning the attack in Gaza. The Ukrainians, on the other hand, very much supportive. Turkey, interestingly, came out also being quite condemning the Gaza operation. But all in all, there wasn't really enough time for the international community to get their act together and to make their statement. By the time they woke up, by the time the United Nations Security Council was putting its meeting together, the operation was over already.
And I would imagine nothing came of that. Of that security
No, I mean,
it wasn't going to anyway, because you've got the United States on the Security Council.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got, you know, obviously the differing interests on the Security Council that are going to be vetoing votes in one direction or the other. So there was never, ever going to be a vote carried out. But it was interesting that the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, spoke about it. Spoke about the operation, and in particular, what was interesting about what he said was the extent to which Iran was controlling things from a distance. They were apparently controlling a lot of what was going on in Gaza, sending messages, sending instructions, sending support, sending whatever they needed to send in order to somehow have a hand in everything that was going on in Gaza. And that was one of the main points that Gilad Erdan made when he addressed the United Nations Security Council.
The final text on the Iran deal was concluded last night and taken away for approval. I'm not sure if this is good news or bad news.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, it seems that the United States and the European Union countries are absolutely hell-bent on somehow reconstituting this Iran deal. And that's what we saw yesterday in Vienna, when finally the so-called final text was agreed upon by the meeting in Vienna, which of course included Iranian negotiators. And the idea now is that that text needs to be taken back to member countries, to their particular governments, in order for those governments to either agree or disagree. And it seems as if, though, the US and the European Union countries are almost inclined to accept this text. And I haven't had a chance to read the text in detail, so I'm not sure what's good and what's bad about it. But I feel quite sure that whatever this is, whatever the text says, it really gives too much space. It gives a lot of leniency to the Iranians in terms of reducing sanctions and in terms of supporting their economy. And these are things that we can ill afford. And what it obviously doesn't talk about is what the Iranians are currently doing while the agreement has not been made, and what the Iranians potentially will be doing after the agreement potentially comes into existence under the surface and out of sight, which, of course, we know they like to do. So what's interesting in all of this is that out of all of the parties who were involved in coming to this final text, it is the Iranian side who seem to be the least inclined to agree to this text. So it seems as if the text doesn't quite go as far as they would like it to go. And there, a negotiator has already expressed some doubts as to whether the Iranian government will agree to this. It seems to me that the Iranian government should be the ones who are agreeing to whatever is laid on the table, just in order to try to somehow free up some of the sanctions. But apparently they're not so inclined to. So maybe we might be saved from the agreement by virtue of the fact that the Iranians don't agree. Time will tell.
It is 7:59. Anthony Rock, thank you as always.